My next guest on West Coast Live is here from England. He is wearing a most magnificent blazer with green and white stripes on it. He's a composer. He's an arranger. He is a pataphysician. He's a pataphysical composer. What is pataphysics? Is it a serious subject that takes silly ideas and lifts them to the notion of ruminability? Or is it a science that examines the absurd with seriousness? We don't know. I'm not sure our next guest does either, but he's written a magnificent book about it called Pataphysics, A Useless Guide. Please welcome Andrew Hugel to West Coast Live. How do you do? How do you do? Please have a seat.
Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks so much for coming. I'm so impressed that you took the ship across the bay from San Francisco.
It was a lovely trip, yes. The weather was quite good this morning, so it was a very nice way to come to do an interview by boat. Yes. First time I've ever done that. Yeah.
But you do like boats. I mean, on your website, in which you list things such as a guide to the orchestra, which is this really complete guide to understanding how an orchestra works and orchestration, you've got a tour of an island in which you've recorded boat sounds and sounds of being aboard, you know, coming aboard this island. You're clearly drawn by the island, by the sea, by water.
Yes, and in fact, for 4 years, I lived on a narrowboat with my wife. A narrowboat is like a canal boat.
A barge or something?
Well, it's not really a barge. Barges are much bigger, but it's designed to go around the waterways of Britain. And we used to cruise around just all the time, and we would moor up somewhere, and I'd find the nearest train station and then be able to go into the university from there, you know. So it was quite a nice lifestyle. So you're quite right, I'm drawn to water. And the island in question you're referring to is called St. George's Island, and it's off the coast at Lewy in Cornwall. It's about a mile offshore, it's about a mile round. And I wrote a whole symphony about this island in four movements, yeah.
It's a the island life. You're an interesting fellow. Who works in music. So if you were to explain to somebody sitting next to you on a plane or on a radio show, what is pataphysics?
Okay, well, I'll give you three very short definitions first and then talk a bit more length. So the first one is pataphysics is the science of imaginary solutions.
Okay.
The second one is...
That sounds like politics here.
The second one is pataphysics is the science of the laws governing exceptions and contradictions. And the third is pataphysics is to metaphysics as metaphysics is to physics.
Okay. So it takes us into another dimensionality of thought.
Exactly. And you will notice from the cover of the book, people probably can't see it, but the word itself has an apostrophe before the first letter. So the apostrophe, according to the writer Alfred Jarry, who used the term a lot, is there to conceal an obvious pun. The problem is he doesn't tell us what the pun actually is.
Which, of course, is part of Jarry's joy. He wrote that renowned play, Ubu Wa.
Yes, and Ubu was really the first pataphysician. We call them pataphysicians rather than pataphysicists for some reason. Ubu started as a way of mocking the science teacher at a school in Rennes in France. And the group of schoolboys, and Jarry was one of them, did some puppet plays, and they featured this science teacher who was a rather incompetent man and didn't really know much about science. So they kept asking him questions that he couldn't answer, and he would have to make up scientific answers. And this became the basis of pataphysics, and that was initially it was a schoolboy joke. And then Jarry developed this character, Ubu, who became... the man's name was Abair. He became Abe, and then that became Ubu. And Ubu was a sort of marionette figure with an enormous spiral drawn on his belly. And the play Ubu Wa was a scandal when it was first performed. People were very shocked by it. It included a very rude word as the first word of the play, and that caused an enormous furor. And then after that, Jarry himself sort of rather took on the persona of Ubu.
So given given this, I'm interested that MIT Press has published this book.
Well, pataphysics is the most serious of all the sciences, you know. And who better than MIT Press to understand that?
I think we're beginning to get the idea. But this is also something, I mean, this book involves the Marx brothers, Albert Roussel, I mean, Jarry, I mean, many people in the philosophical world are used to illuminate the world of pataphysics. What is a pataphysical musician?
Well, that's even more difficult to describe than just a pataphysician. I don't think there is one form of pataphysical music, but pataphysical music has been made down the ages. To give you an example, the Beatles made a song, Maxwell's Silver Hammer, which contains the line, "Joan was quizzical, studied pataphysical science in the home." People may remember that. So that's one kind of popular music. Then the band Soft Machine, who were a prog rock sort of free improv band. There's a lot of free jazz that acknowledges pataphysics. And then more controlled composition, often using systems of various kinds, mathematical systems. There's quite a lot of game playing in pataphysics. So the idea of writing music that in some way engages in some kind of intellectual game is part of that compositional style.
And do you, as somebody who also writes music and deals with orchestration and so forth, do you bring the pataphysics into that world, or do you sometimes keep them separate, or is it a separate entity from that realm?
Well, I think probably I couldn't keep it separate because I've been so immersed in this stuff for 25 years. It's hard to remove it from the mind altogether. But there are pieces of mine that are more explicitly pataphysical than others. I suppose the best-known piece I've written is a piece called Catalogue de Grenouilles, Catalogue of Frogs. And this is a piece for about 300 frogs and piano. So you can see straight away that this is a combination that really shouldn't work.
What about your piece for dancing toothpicks?
Ah, yes, this has been used as the theme for the Carnival Pataphysique, which is currently going on in San Francisco. This was written to celebrate the death day of Jarry, which was November the 1st. And Jarry's last request on his deathbed was for a toothpick. most people would ask for the last rites, but Jarry asked for a toothpick as the measure of the man. So I wrote a little waltz to celebrate this moment.
Part of this carnival includes, as I understand it, taking a map of Paris and overlaying it with the topography of San Francisco and going around the city of San Francisco as if you're in Paris?
That's exactly it. For people who want to take part, we're leaving from City Lights bookstore at 1 p.m. today. City Lights becomes Shakespeare and Company for the day. And then we're setting off on a tour of San Francisco using a map of Paris, visiting various islands. And at each island, there will be some kind of performance or event. There are going to be about half a dozen of these islands. They all have titles that come from Jarry's novel, Dr. Faustrol, Pataphysician. So the islands are very evocative of pataphysics.
James Joyce gets into this somehow.
Well, I think particularly Finnegan's Wake and the idea of epiphany, the sudden moment of insight. Pataphysics is full of these little strange little moments. The apostrophe before the word is an example, in a way. It's something that just upsets you or makes you see things slightly differently. So, for example, the idea of clinamen, which is a swerve, just a swerve away from the expected path, or something like a syzygy. Syzygy is S-Y-Z-Y-G-Y.
Oh, it's my favourite hangman word.
Oh, right, yeah, it would be. Yeah, that's great. Well, the syzygy is when three bodies, usually in the heavens, align perhaps unexpectedly. So an eclipse is an example of a syzygy. And Jarry talks about the syzygy of words. This is when words suddenly align, such as in a pun, for example, when suddenly meanings collide. So there's a lot of this playing with words, and of course that's what Joyce did. He talked about the revolution of the word, and he wanted to develop a new language. So Finnegan's Wake is, in a sense, an invented language.
I like the idea that you could have syzygies in language. You know, it never occurred to me that until I came across pataphysics. What about how does someone like Borges fit into this?
Well, Borges really, I think, described the College de Pataphysique in his text, Tlon Ukbar Orbis Tertius.
Of course.
Yeah. which describes these metaphysicians of Tlon who are engaged on a very difficult intellectual quest guided only by psychology. But the problem is you can never discover where they are because there's an entry in an encyclopedia that someone saw once but is never seen again. So this place is an imaginary place, but it has its own peculiar rules. Also, the Library of Babel of Borges, which is the library made up of hexagonal rooms that tessellate rather like a honeycomb. And each one of these contains books that have every possible permutation of all the letters of the alphabet over and over again in a random succession. And the librarians in this enormous library that goes on forever are driven mad by the quest to find a book that makes sense.
This is a fun field you're in. So in here, there's an example here of, about the time of day where a negative plus the number 8 equals the word for night. In French, oui, nuit, nuit. Italian, otto, ne otto notte. Spanish, ocho, ne ocho noche. Acht, ne acht, nacht. English, 8, ne 8, night. Well, it's a stretch. Swedish, äta, nata.
Yeah.
How does that fit in?
Well, this was written by a very extraordinary individual called Jean-Pierre Brisset. Brisset worked at a little railway station in a village in France, and he was the sort of chief assistant to the assistant chief. You know, he didn't have much to do. There were only a few trains a day.
And many assistants.
So in his spare time, he came up with a theory of the universe, which is what you do when you've got nothing better to do. And his theory was based on language. He was a very religious man, and he believed that, you know, in the beginning was the word. It's just that the word that he heard was spoken by frogs. So he heard frogs speaking these little sounds, and the first word of our ancestors was qua. Qua means what? And he said this was the first question. And then the second word was pourquoi. And so on. And it kind of goes downhill from there. So his books are enormous catalogues of puns in French, of which that was a good example, that for him, expose what he regards as the hidden truth, the hidden law of the universe, which is that everything is meaningful and that man is descended from the frog.
I think this is beginning to make sense. I understand it. Eugene Ionesco.
Well, people know Ionesco, of course, as the absurdist writer par excellence, and his play, The Bull Prima Donna, was an example of pataphysics, and he was very involved in the College of Pataphysics just after the war. The college was formed in France by a group of intellectuals who I think were interested in avoiding the repression of some of the orthodoxies and factions that existed in Paris at the time. So you had political factions, intellectual factions, and so on, Stalinists, Marxists, right-wingers, and etc. The College of Pataphysics was a sort of a rebuff to that. It had humour, it had a lightness of touch, and it had a dedication to a quiet scholarship. And Ionesco was very much involved in that that formation. So this idea of absurdism that really developed out of Jarry's Ubuwah was picked up by Ionesco and developed in the way that I guess people know his writing.
And at what point do we get back to relativity, mathematics, the world of traditional physics?
Well, there's some surprising connections, particularly theories of antimatter. Jarry himself wrote a lot about ideas that he derived from Lord Kelvin, who was the big name scientist at the end of the 19th century, and his ideas of a luminiferous ether. And the luminiferous ether was reckoned to be a substance that existed in the universe that was all around us but that you couldn't detect. And the word ether obviously has that connotation of something mysterious. And Jarry, as he did always, he parodied this writing by Lord Kelvin, but in doing so developed an idea of his own, which he called eternity. And eternity was a concept based on his own life, because everything in pataphysics is very subjective. He was a prodigious drinker. He drank vast amounts each day, including absinthe, and towards the end of his life, ether from chemical laboratories, which, needless to say, wasn't very good for his health, and he died aged 34. But the ideas of physics then permeate pataphysics, and if we fast forward to the present day, lo and behold, this same idea of the luminiferous ether comes up again, except, of course, scientists won't use the word ether. They'll use the word antimatter instead. And there's some similarity also with quantum mechanics, I think, the idea that you don't know where anything is at any given moment. One of the fundamental principles of pataphysics is that traditional science, which relies on the repeatable experiment, is too general. To be particular, each experiment has to be a unique occurrence and could behave in any way.
This sounds like Heisenberg and his principle of uncertainty.
Exactly, yes. I think there's a clear connection there. And there's too much at stake, I think, for serious physicists to admit any connection with something as lunatic as pataphysics. In fact, I'm friends with one of the scientists on the CERN particle accelerator, and he says that when physicists are gathered together and one of them makes questionable science, the others will shout, that's not physics, that's pataphysics.
But in a way, so much of what can't be seen, you know, that does go on in the world of physics, and that we will develop human constructs to make the proof, is a way also an imaginary solution. It comes out of the human imagination.
Exactly, and I think the important thing is that pataphysics is subjective. So whereas physics generally aims towards objectivity, pataphysics is completely subjective. So it's about your own perception rather than the objective reality that is supposedly in front of us.
You're a professor at De Montfort University in England, and you're also a commandeur requis of the Ordre de la Grande Jidouille in the Collège de Pataphysique.
Oui, c'est vrai.
C'est vrai. What is it? What is the Grande Jidouille?
Okay, the Grande Jidouille is the big spiral that's painted on Ubu's belly and becomes the symbol of pataphysics. A spiral, you know, when you draw a spiral, there are two spirals. There's the one you draw, and then there's the one that's created by the one you draw. And this symbolizes the opposition that constantly exists in pataphysics. You have the plus and the minus simultaneously existing. So in the pataphysical universe, things that mutually exclude one another can and do exist simultaneously. So you'll notice that my jacket that you pointed out earlier has a plaque. This is my pataphysical plaque here, issued by the Collège de Pataphysique.
It's a spiral. It looks like a porcelain spiral, the golden spiral.
That's it. And the colour is pink, which symbolises the rank of commandeur requis. That means a necessary commander. So I'm a necessary commander of the Order of the Grande Jidouille.
And what are your privileges?
Well, I'm allowed to do things like this, for example, which is rather important. The Collège de Pataphysique is a very peculiar organisation, as you can imagine. In about the mid-70s, it occulted. Occulted, yes. It went into shadow and made no public manifestations for a very long time. And then it was announced towards the end of the 1990s that it would disoccult in the year 2000. But people in the college were not sure whether that was the year 2000 AD or the year 2000 EP, which is the pataphysical era, which is dated from the birth of Jarry, which would have meant waiting another couple of millennia before we got to the disoccultation. Fortunately, the vice curator ruled that it was 2000 AD, and so I'm able to talk to you today for that reason.
Otherwise, who knows when we'd ever hear about this. I mean, where do Frank Zappa and Bill Griffith, who created Zippy the Pinhead, come into this?
Well, Zippy is modelled on Ubu. The head of Zippy has the same shape as the figure of Ubu, that pinhead shape. And his Moo-Moo outfit, the clown's outfit, is rather marionette-like, is rather Ubu-esque. And that line, the famous catchphrase, you know, are we having fun yet, is very pataphysical. Frank Zappa, the connection is perhaps a little looser. I don't think he acknowledged pataphysics directly in his work, But he's very much in that spirit and clearly knew about pataphysics because there are many references that connect with Jarry in his composition.
As you can tell, you want to go hang out with this guy and go for a tour of San Francisco.
I used to go drinking with Bill Griffiths, and we had conversations like that.
Oh, really?
When he lived here.
Wow.
Well, you should tell Andrew some stories then. Did he mention Ubu?
No, he didn't mention
Ubu. Oh, okay. But did he?
But the conversations were just as abstract.
Oh, I don't know. This hasn't been abstract to me at all. I mean, the book is called, Pataphysics, A Useless Guide, by Andrew Hugill, H-U-G-I-L-L, and he's collaborating on this project, this Carnival, this weekend through City Lights Bookstore in San Francisco. Join in if you'd like details through our website at wcl.org or through City Lights Books. Andrew, a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Always nice to meet a necessary commander. Thank you very much for coming out to West Coast Live, taking the ship in. Ladies and gentlemen, we look forward to seeing you either in Ashland or...